Good morning. It's good to see you here. Welcome to Sunday school or Christian education or whatever you want to call it. Doesn't matter to me. So we started last week a new series this year called Eschatology. And last week we looked at how eschatology is really why God created man, and it was to bring us into this place, a place where we're with God forever, sinless. We see his glory. The things of God are not invisible to us anymore. And so even before the fall, that we were still going there. And then Adam, if he would have obeyed, would have brought us as our covenant head to that place eventually. And so it's important to remember that the theme of the Bible is eschatology, is how is God going to bring sinful, fallen man to the place he designed him for? The first way he was going to do it was through Adam and through Adam's obedience, our federal head. When Adam failed, it was clear it would be a second Adam, a greater Adam, who would succeed where Adam failed, Christ. This was all in God's eternal plan, but it would come through the first Adam, and then if he failed, the second Adam. But eschatology is always the theme. It's never the theme that God sent Jesus to make this temporary world a bit better. That would be classic liberalism. That God just brought Christianity because he wanted the structures of this world to be nicer. Even though we're going to die, at least for a while, the world is nice. It's always been the eternal goal. So that's what we learned last week. Now we're going to start now that we've had a general overview of the Bible, to work our way through the Old Testament to see how this theme of eschatology is throughout the Old Testament, different places. And today, as you see in your notes, it's on the Garden of Eden. So Eden, when it was created, becomes a replica of heaven. We talked a little bit about this last week. So God creates an invisible realm first called heaven. He creates a visible realm, and there's a garden there, and the garden is where God fellowships with man. It's God's throne room. Now we know God actually, in the Genesis account, he rested where? He rested on his throne in heaven, in the invisible heavens. So it says at the end of, or at Genesis, at the end of 1 and then in Genesis 2, God rested. We talked about last week what that word rest means in the Bible. What does it mean? Yeah, he sat as the ruler over his creation. It doesn't mean he was tired, so he was resting that way. It means he sat on his throne. So he sits on his throne in heaven, but then in earth, there's a place that Adam and God meet. So now we have a replica of the heavenly place on earth called Eden. We have the throne of God in the sense that that's where God is going to temporarily reside in a sense, to meet with Adam and Eve in the garden. And so if you turn to Ezekiel 28, this is an important passage. Now, Ezekiel 28 does something interesting. There's a king of Tyre, and that's a city along the coast, and the king was very evil. Even though in God's common grace he gave him the opportunity to rule, he rebelled as much as possible against God, set himself up as his own God, and God judges the king or prince, depending on your translation of Tyre. But in this prophecy and speaking against the king, he speaks of him like he was in the garden. And so, for example, somebody read 13 and 14. You can skip the names and go down to 14. And so he treats He treats the king as if he was in the Garden of Eden and was exiled out. But notice how the garden is first called the Holy Mountain of God. And then look in 13. You were in Eden, the Garden of God. And then the Mountain of God. And so these were, Eden was called the Garden of God and the Mountain of God. Now, in one sense, the whole world he created belonged to God, right? We know that from creation. But in a very unique sense, Eden is called the Garden of God. So in other words, this is a special place that God had created for his presence to be. Now, there's among scholars, there's difference of who is behind this. Is it Satan or is it Adam? Both were in the garden. Both were exiled, in a sense, cast out. So who is he referring to that the king reminds him of? That's an open question. Most of you probably heard this refers to Satan, right? If you've heard this at all. Anyone ever heard this maybe Adam? No? It doesn't really matter for the point. The point is simply that we learn more about the Garden of Eden from Ezekiel 28 because it uses this as a reference. So we learn in Genesis 13, remember when Lot looked over the plains of Sodom? And if someone want to read that, Genesis 13:10. And so the land was fertile and green like what? Like Eden, like the Garden of God. So when we look at other portions of the Bible, we learn more about this place that is going to picture heaven. We learn that it's fertile. It's very beautiful, luscious, and green. We learn, look at Genesis 2:10. Somebody read that. So a river is flowing out of Eden to water everything else below. That tells you that Eden was higher up, right? It's the only way water can flow to everything else. So Eden is higher up, and from Eden come the springs of life. Now, where do we see again this picture of a river giving life? Where in the Bible? Revelation at the end. In the new heavens and earth, there's a river flowing, giving life to everyone. So again, we have a picture of heaven, because life does come from heaven, right? Spiritual life comes from above. We have a picture of Eden being heaven. If you look at Ezekiel 47:12, somebody read that. First, some of you are way faster than me getting to these ones. So again, the new heavens and earth is pictured like a what? What does that say? Like a garden, right? It's a beautiful garden. And so already what we have here is a replica of this and sort of a looking ahead of the new heavens and earth. Eden is a replica of heaven. Now, and then finally, Eden pointed ahead to what awaited a fulfillment of the creation mandate. In other words, when Adam was told that he and his descendants were to take dominion over the earth and rule and fill the earth, Eden would be a picture of the end of that. That one day the earth will be like Eden all the way around. And the tree of life would be there, what we see in Revelation. So that brings us to two. We learn more about Eden by looking at another type of heaven, which is Canaan. Because there's all kinds of connections between Canaan and Eden. How is Canaan first described to the Israelites? A land flowing with milk and honey. Again, a vegetation reference to a lush place. God is enthroned at his Sabbath rest here, right? And then he lives on the mountain, in a sense, enthroned. And when Israel takes conquest of Canaan and there's a temple, what does it say? God rests in his temple. So now you have Canaan, a land where God's people live with him in fellowship, and he's present. God in his temple rests again. So he rests here, and then there's a picture that he rests here. And when the temple is built, many of the decorations resemble Eden. And so you can look at some of the decorations of the temple. It was a garden-like. You had figs and things as you got closer to the Holy of Holies. So it was like a glorified garden. Everything still pointing ahead. And so Hebrews 3:5, when Israel entered their rest in the land and God lived among them, that's how it's phrased. God entered his rest and they entered his rest. That's really the hope here, right? God enters his rest, man works. We talked about last week. That means that eventually man would rest too, like God did. And so in Canaan, we have the same thing. Israel enters rest, it says. Now, what do we call that rest? Is that the eternal rest of here? No. So what is it? What do you call it? It's a type, right? And so Canaan becomes a type of the new heavens and earth. So you see the direct connection that God returns what he did here, he does it again in Canaan. Now both are theocratic orders. In other words, Adam in the garden was told how to remain in the garden. Obey the law of God. And what was the law? Do not eat of the fruit. That was the specific law. Israel, if they're going to remain in land, need to obey God's law. And what's that? Yeah, the Mosaic law summarized in the Ten Commandments. And so you have a similar situation with man there. Both have sanctuaries to guard. Remember we talked about that. Adam was told to guard the garden. Now that word guard is a priestly word. It means guard the presence of God from being defiled. That same word shamar in the Hebrew to guard was given to the priests when it concerns the temple. The priests were told, guard the sanctuary. Adam was told, guard the sanctuary, guard the presence of God on this mountain. Now, how would Adam have guarded the sanctuary from being defiled? Yeah, he would have defeated the serpent by refusing the temptation. And that would have not given Satan an in the garden. And so the priests were to guard the defilement of God's temple here, just like Adam was to guard the defilement of God's temple here. Both are paradise lands to be cultivated and enjoyed, right? Adam was to fill the earth. Israel was allotted the 12 areas of Canaan to be theirs. Both contain a covenant of works to remain in. Adam needed to obey the law of God, not to eat of the fruit, or he would be exiled out, and that's what happened, right? Israel was to obey the law of God and not worship other gods, or they would be exiled out. And what happened in 586 BC? Exile, right? They were exiled to Babylon. Adam was exiled when he didn't obey the law. So you see a similar temple reference. Now, both are mountains. What's the mountain in Canaan called? Zion. Now, if you're from a place like New Mexico or other places, Zion is not considered a mountain because we lived in a place where the mountain right next to us in New Mexico was 10,000 feet, and we looked up from our backyard. That's a mountain. In Texas, that would be a mountain because we don't have the reference. So there's not a lot of high mountains in Israel in the central part. And so Zion is a hill, but it's called Mount Zion. It just depends where you're from, right? So don't you ever have people move here and they'll always say to you, that's not a mountain. You ever hear that? Because what they're used to. You've said that before? People say that's a mountain and you say that's not a mountain. That's right. I used to live by a mountain. But all throughout the Bible, the hill that the temple is on is called Mount Zion. It's not Hill Zion. It sounds kind of odd, right? It's Mount Zion because mountains are important. Now, if you go back to Ezekiel 28, where was Eden? On a mountain. And we just read that. It's called the Mountain of God. The only way water can flow down if it's coming down from a mountain, right? And water everything below. So normally in your mind, when you picture Eden, you do not picture a mountain, do you? You picture flat land and a garden. But the Bible pictured it as walking up a mountain and maybe a little plateau very high where there's a garden. And water flowing from there as it rains on the mountain down to the lands below. And if you're wondering, then Ezekiel calls Eden the Mountain of God. And so, actually, that's this. If you're wondering what that is, that's not greater than from above. It's a mountain. So, God's presence in Eden was on a mountain. You went up to meet with God. God's presence in Canaan was on a mountain. You went up to meet with God, right? You ascended to the mountain of the Lord. Any questions so far? There's a lot more about Eden in the Bible than you may have thought, right? Because people tend to just read Genesis and they don't really look through the rest of the Bible what it says about Eden. Any thoughts or questions before we go on? Yes. Yes. Exactly. So, turn to Isaiah 14:13 is an important verse. Eden is a picture then of God's heavenly mountain. Because when you get to the book of Revelation and it describes heaven, it describes heaven as God's Mount of Assembly or Harmageddon. That's a Greek translation of the Hebrew, Harmoed. So you have you've heard of Armageddon or Harmageddon, right? It's actually a mountain in the book of Revelation. So it's called the Mountain of God, where God's people will meet him. Where else have we seen God meet his people on mountains in the Bible? Sinai? Olives? What was that meeting? In Matthew, yeah. What else? What about Moriah? Where did God meet his... Who met God on Mount Moriah? Abraham. Remember, that's where he sacrificed. He almost sacrificed his son. So the theme of God's presence on the earth being a picture of the heavenly mountain is all throughout the Bible. So someone read Isaiah 14:13. So now this is a taunt to the king of Babylon. It's the same type of taunt. And even the king of Babylon is now pictured as somebody who had the authority and blessings of Eden, the exaltation of being in God's presence and then being cast down. But now notice how in verse 13, it's called the Mount of Assembly. And then the Mount Zaphon, it says in the Hebrew. But verse 15, but you are brought down to the far reaches of the pit. And so, like Satan, you said, or Adam, however you take that, I will ascend to the mountain of God and be like God. But you are cast down. So now the mountain is called the Mount of Assembly. Who assembled on this mountain here? God and Adam and Eve, right? And we see even Adam and Eve's children, they're outside the garden now, but they come and worship in Genesis 4. They're still at the foot of the mountain. Mount Zaphon, the King James will actually say Zaphon, right? Anyone have a King James here? No King James people left? Boy, what happened? Usually in a church, there's somebody who's King James is still at no one. All right. It says it. Anyway. We're told, and look at verse 13, the one that YC was about to read. Eden was a place shining with gemstones. Right? Now, you don't usually think of that, right? You think of the garden and you think of trees. Do you think of gemstones shining? And yet here, that's how Eden's described. Again, picturing the glorious presence of God, the glorious mountains of God. And so Eden then would be for mankind, even if he hadn't fell, the place of worship. When man was spreading out in that area, when it was time to worship God, where would they go? They would come back to the mountain. They would ascend up to the garden. And who would have been working there to keep that garden beautiful? Adam. That was his job, right? You shall guard and tend. Those are the two words. Tend the garden and guard the garden. Tending it would be keeping it. Well, you're gardeners, right? You know what tend means. And then guard it against being defiled by sin. So Adam would have stayed there. The rest of mankind would have ascended the mountain like they're ascending up to heaven. It would be a picture of the future when this God would return and in the sense of glorifying the earth and the invisible would become visible. So Eden was to be the spiritual center of the world before man fell. It was the temple of God. It was like in Canaan when you wanted to worship, what'd you have to do? In the Old Testament. You had to go to the temple, right? You were in all the cities, and three times a year, unless you had your own sacrifice and you went on your own, you would come and worship at Zion. Come to the mountain and worship God. That same thing would have been happening if man hadn't fallen. Come to the mountain and worship God. Adam, the priest, is there tending the garden to be the presence of God. That was his job. And so you can imagine the ascending of Eden to the presence of the Lord. It's like you're going to heaven, and it's again showing man that this work you're doing, this test Adam is under, will end, and what this mountain pictures will come. You'll be in that place you were created for. So it's interesting in Psalm 24, when the palace or presence of God is pictured, where is it? I ascended the mountain of the Lord. Who can ascend? Remember Psalm 24? Who can ascend the hill or mountain of the Lord? So again, the Lord is pictured up on his mountain, and the question is, who can go up there in his presence? We're all sinners. And in Psalm 24, what's the answer? The King of Glory can go in. Who's the King of Glory? Christ, right? Christ can enter for us, representing us. Now, that will help you understand Genesis 11, because after man is kicked out and the garden shrivels up, and the only way man now will ever get into God's presence if God reaches down and saves man somehow, right? Through the covenant of grace, the unbelievers build the Tower of Babel. Now, what was the Tower of Babel? It was a what? It was a temple. It was a place where man would create a god and then go up to meet God. It was in ancient times called a ziggurat. And a ziggurat was like a pyramid with steps. And you worked your way up, and on top is where the altar was. And so they created their own religion, and they said, man can ascend up to the presence of God on his own. He doesn't need salvation. He can build his own temple. So Babel is the very essence of all religions, right? That man can do something to earn eternal life, to enter the presence of God. And so that's why what they're building is a false religion. It really was a pseudo-Eden. Now, Eden was in all their consciousness. It's in their common grace memories because they're always building temples, right? They're always building mountain pictures to reach the Lord. Even the Canaanites, where did they worship God? It says, don't worship God in the high places. So even they had some sense from their creation, from Eden, that God shows himself up high as a picture of heaven. So even they, when they would meet their gods, they would go to the highest place in Canaan. Again, we would not call those mountains. You've seen pictures of Israel, right? And they call a mountain. You look at it where you're from and you think, I could probably walk up there in half an hour. So you don't think of that. But they were called mountains. Now, when you get to Sinai, they're much higher, but I'm talking about Israel. So what was I just saying? The high places. They would pick the highest place in Canaan. And so now Christ then becomes the mediator that gives us access to the mountain of God, right? It's interesting, when Jacob falls asleep at Bethel, God gives him a vision of what? A staircase going up to heaven. But what's happening? Is he descending, ascending, or is someone descending? Yeah, they're descending down. In other words, Jacob, if you're going to make it back up, someone's going to have to come down and get you. Problem is, you're a sinner. It was pretty obvious to Jacob, he's a sinner, right? He was a deceiver. And so Jesus, one of the ways to explain the gospel is, we were created to worship God and be with him on his holy mountain. But man fell and was kicked out of his mountain. God provided a picture to the Jews that through the sacrifices, they can come back to the mountain and worship God. But those were only pictures, because animals cannot take away your sin, right? And so the only one that can bring us to the mountain, finally, is Christ. He gives us perfect access. Now, one more point, It's interesting that Jesus' first sermon is where? On a mountain, Sermon on the Mount. And if you compare Sinai with the Sermon on the Mount, you'll see the difference between the law and the gospel. Because Israel, when they approached God on Sinai, what was the problem there? What was going on? When Israel was saved from Egypt and they came to the mountain of God, now Sinai is called the mountain of God. Remember, Eden was called the mountain of God. It shrivels up. Now Sinai here is the mountain of God. Once Zion comes, that takes over, right? Then the rest of the Old Testament, Zion is the mountain of God. But before the temple, Sinai is the mountain of God. When Israel approached, what happened? Earthquakes, thunder, darkness, smoke. And what did God say to the Israelites? Do not touch the mountain lest you die. So in other words, even though I've redeemed you from Egypt, that didn't take away your sin. You still can't approach me. That deliverance was not the true deliverance. That was only a picture. Because when they, after that, they tried to come near the mountain of God, and God said, stay away from me. You're unclean. And the only way you can approach me is through what? A mediator, Moses. Moses picturing Christ. So, on Sinai, Moses gives the law, and everybody backs up and says, we can't be near God. So what does that show about the law? The law cannot save. Nobody can obey the law enough to earn the right to be in God's holy presence. So the law only pushed them away in a sense. And so that's the law. The law says, here is what is required to be in my presence. Obey this perfectly. Because man can't do it, man is told, stay away. You come near, you're going to get killed. You're going to die. Jesus' first sermon, he's the new Moses. He's the new prophet. Moses said, God will raise up somebody from our people. He listened to him. His first sermon is on a mountain. He is the presence of God, right? The reason on Sinai they couldn't come near is because God was there. And sinful people cannot get in the presence of God unless they're perfect. Then they wouldn't be sinful, right? Jesus' first sermon is on a mountain, but now who gets to go on the mountain? Everyone. Jesus invites people up on the mountain, and what does he tell them who are blessed? Blessed are the poor in spirit. The law says, if you want to be blessed, obey the law. Jesus in the gospel says, who is blessed? Those who admit they cannot obey the law. See the difference between the law and the gospel? And so instead of Jesus saying, I'm the presence of God, stay away. I mean, Jesus was even more the presence of God than clouds, right? Or thunder or earthquakes. Jesus was God in the flesh. And yet people can come near and they're told, you can be with me, pictured on a mountain, Not by being perfect, but by what? Humbling yourself like a child and admitting your need for salvation, crying out for mercy. So blessed are the poor in spirit was not heard on Mount Sinai, was it? God didn't say to Israel, you must obey the law, but if you can't, don't worry about it. Come on up anyways. Be in my presence. He didn't say that, did he? Christ says that in the gospel. So what the law cannot do, Christ did for us, right? So if you're going to understand the Bible, you have to understand the difference between the law and the gospel. Yes? Yeah, the law did have provisions typologically that now that you can't obey, what must you look for? Sacrificial system, for example. Right. Yes. Yeah, the law was an administration, as we say in theology, of the covenant of grace, because it drove them to Christ. It showed them, you Israel cannot keep the law. You cannot get to my presence this way. You need someone to do it for you. And so it's showing them, it's teaching them the gospel. So if they would have understood the law rightly, they would have believed in Jesus, right? Because Jesus said to the Pharisees, you read the Bible all day, but you don't see how it points to me as fulfilling the law. So, summary, Eden was eschatological. It provided a foretaste of the new heavens and earth, of man fellowshipping with God on his mountain. And the very fact that Adam could do it showed that Adam is a picture of Christ, because Adam represented all mankind like Christ represented his people. And so what are any thoughts, questions, or implications of understanding this? Yes. Right. Yeah, think of the rich young ruler. He wanted to justify himself because he thought he was good. And so Jesus said to him, if you really want to prove you're good, what must you do? Yeah, obey the law to its entirety. Every aspect of the law. You must keep, when Jesus told people they must keep the commandments to be saved, he was showing what the law required, if that's what they wanted. Now, why did he tell them that? Right, to show them that they need another way. Yes. Did you all hear that question? That's a common, it's a good question. That is, how long would have the probation lasted for Adam? Let's say he didn't accept Eve's temptation to eat the fruit. How long would that still been an issue of probation? We don't know exactly. It's just an open question. We know it couldn't have been forever. Couldn't have been at that moment or could have lasted. It's a hard question to know. When you say they, do you mean all mankind? Born from Adam? Right. Would God's character allow a continual state of you can fall at any time? Right. We talked about that a little last week, that no, eventually the test would have to end. We just don't know how long the test would have gone. The Jews don't rely on the temple system to make them right with God. They rely on their chosen ethnicity, that God has made promises to them as Jews. So the very fact that there's not a temple doesn't take away the promises that Jews are just God's people, period. But they wouldn't read the law that way. They just see the law as a blessing that separates them from the Gentiles. We're talking about the very conservative Jews who actually know anything, which is very few. So no, they look at the law as what makes them different and better. Yeah, well, the real strict ones would say they do, but yeah. Not perfectly, but they don't think they have to perfectly, just generally. I mean, no Jew would say I'm perfect. We think we are. No, I'm kidding. Right, but they would say God himself took down the temple. There's nothing they can do about it, but it doesn't take away the promise. Well, because they had formerly as a nation said that Yahweh is no longer our God, and we officially worship idols. We see that in Jeremiah. At that point, when they divorced themselves from God, it being their God as a nation, God said, now we're sending you as a nation into exile. Yeah, on a national scale. There are obviously believers within Israel that still belong to God eternally. But nationally, they had turned against the Lord. And we'll get to that and how Israel plays in, but yeah. But you see the underlying covenant of grace through it all, because here, Jeremiah is one of the exiles. So Jeremiah is being kicked out of God's presence, but he's a believer in the covenant. He's a believer in the gospel. He's an elect, right? But in this picture, he's being exiled with the people. So you have to have this understructure of all saved by the same gospel from the beginning of the fall, right? Any other thoughts? If nothing else, from this point on, the rest of your life, whenever you picture Eden, I hope you think of a mountain. Because what that will do is open up the biblical theology, the way the whole Bible opens up about God meeting his people on mountains. It'll give you a fuller picture, and why at the end of the world, when Christ returns, it's pictured as a return to the mountain. Yes. We're elected from a fallen condition. That's what we're elected out of. In God's mind, there is, but working that all out is a little beyond us. Yeah, that's one of those questions that you can speculate forever, but we're told both. We're told Adam needed to obey to get, and then we're also told God elects, but he elects sinners. I mean, that's the picture, fallen people. Any other questions or thoughts? Yes. Yes, we are. We will gather at the Mount of Assembly when Christ returns. Matter of fact, what does that say about what we do in about 15 minutes? What mountain are we worshiping at? You have come to the heavenly mountain, Hebrews, right? Because of Christ, we don't have any earthly pictures anymore. We don't have a literal mountain we have to go to, right? We'd be in trouble in Texas, wouldn't we? We'd have to build an awful big. But when we worship through Christ, we have access to the heavenly mountain, to that which all this is picturing. And we do that here by faith, right? It gives a whole new level what we're doing in worship. We are in God's presence with his angels on the heavenly mountain. Well, that may be a good time to pray. So let's pray.